from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. How can we put an end to truck rollovers?
A semi-truck crashed near I-75 in Valdosta around 1:30 Thursday morning. Authorities say the semi came to a stop upside down.
Today we'll explain why rollover accidents are such a problem in Georgia and what's being done about it. First, though, we talked about how technology can be disruptive in the classroom. University of Georgia professor John Solosky says he's banned phones, tablets, and laptops in his classes, and he says students are now more engaged.
So we can talk about issues and actually get into some depth with them. The other thing, it lowers a physical barrier. When you're in an auditorium setting and you're looking up and all you see are screens in front of all your students, there's a real physical barrier that you can't see the students.
Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name's Carlton Wheatley. I'm a student at the University of North Georgia. Now that I'm going back to college as an older student, it's just incredibly distracting to see anytime the professor starts talking, half the class has their head down just staring at their phone, and it's just so hard to understand for me that this is how people are attempting to learn.
On Twitter, Sam Burnham writes that when properly implemented, technology in the classroom is invaluable. He says the distraction would be to not have technology. You can call us, like Carlton did, at 404-500-9457, or find us on Twitter, like Sam did. We're at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia could make it more difficult for underage girls to get an abortion. Legislation has been filed in the Georgia State Senate that would require underage girls to justify why they should be allowed to avoid notifying a parent or guardian if they're getting an abortion. At the federal level, President Trump has vowed to see the Roe v. Wade decision overturned. We've explored the abortion debate on this show before. Now we want to take the politics out of it and just talk about the science. For that, I invited Dee Dee St. Louis to join us last year. She's a physician for reproductive health based in Atlanta. So I want to sort of walk us through some of the most common misconceptions there are about abortion. And this is, again, taking politics out of and just staying straight with the science in and of itself. And one of the first one arguments that you hear a lot is that abortion is never medically necessary. Is that true?
That is clearly not true. There are circumstances during which, either for the mother's life or because of issues with the fetus, that women will need to have a termination of pregnancy.
So in other words, abortion, as far as medical doctors are concerned, is sometimes a life-saving procedure.
Absolutely. Abortion is part of the continuum of care that we provide to our, to the women who come to take care, to come to us for care.
Okay, so another one is that abortions are inherently unsafe. How safe or unsafe is the procedure?
That is, again, an unfortunate common misconception. Abortion is one of the safest procedures that we provide. To put it into context, it is about 10 to 15 times safer than actually childbirth.
10 to 15 times safer, okay, than giving childbirth. Okay, so here's another one, and this one's a little odd. Abortions cause breast cancer. Is that true? Does your risk for breast cancer go up?
Again, that is clearly another misconception. The risk of breast cancer is not increased by having an abortion.
Is there any, have we established any connection at all between the risk for cancer and whether you have an abortion or not?
Thus far, if you look at the evidence that is in the medicine and you look at the clear evidence, there is no connection between your risk of breast cancer and the abortion or the number of abortion you have had.
Do women who come to you have these concerns? Do they ask you, will this cause breast cancer? Is it unsafe?
Absolutely. When women come to us, they come to us with a lot of misconception. They come to us having a lot of stigma attached to the decision that they've made. And part of my job, part of all of the physicians who provide this type of care's job, is to sit down with the patient and outline the evidence-based medicine, counsel them as we would for any other procedure, and make sure that they have all the information they need to make their decision.
I mean, we'll get back to more of these misconceptions, but how complicated is that job to just present the medical evidence to a patient without getting all of these political/religious issues brought into it? Does that make your job more complicated?
No, I think my job is to make sure that she has the information she needs. And so we sit down. It's a conversation. I answer her questions. I counsel her as I would any patients for any other procedure. And then I listen to her questions, answer her questions. A lot of it is also providing emotional support. They need to know that someone supports them in the decision that they've made.
Okay, so let's get back. Another really common thought about abortion is that it's possible to cause infertility. Is that true?
No, it's not true. The risk of infertility is not increased by having an abortion.
At all?
No, it's not. When a person has an abortion in the context of a safe medical procedure with a provider and has access to the most recent evidence-based care, the patient's risk of infertility is not increased.
Okay, so since you talked about safe procedures with a licensed provider, let's go to another one, which is that if abortion is illegal, women will not get abortions. Now, I can actually debunk this one myself. We have estimates of the number of illegal abortions that occurred in the 1950s and 60s. Obviously, they were illegal. It's impossible to have exact numbers, but they range from 200,000 to 1.2 million per year. And in the year 1930, illegal abortion was the cause of death for nearly 3,000 women. Of course, those are the only ones in which we have the records. It's quite likely that that number is considerably higher. So why do you make the distinction? How dangerous is an illegal abortion?
Well, when an abortion is done in an illegal setting, the patient has no way of knowing, of ascertaining whether the provider has been properly trained, whether the provider is licensed, whether the conditions under which she's having her procedure are safe and sanitary. Having abortion being part of a continuum of care allows us to provide it in a setting where it is safe, it is sanitary, the providers are trained and licensed. We're all trained, licensed, board-certified OBGYN who are providing this care, part of the continuum of care.
Well, that brings us to the argument that clinics that provide abortions need to have the same regulations and strictures put them on as an ambulatory surgery center. And they say that's for the safety of the patient. How often does an abortion result in a complication in which they have to be rushed to a hospital?
So abortions provided in self-standing health centers rarely do end up with a patient having to be transferred. However, all of the clinics who provide abortion care have protocols in place to manage that as an emergency so that when a patient does need to be transferred, we know how to transfer the patient quickly, efficiently, and safely, and to make sure that she gets to the nearest hospital that will provide her the continuum of care and pick up where we leave off.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dee Dee St. Louis. She's a physician for reproductive health in Atlanta. And again, today we just wanted to focus on the science, what can be established, facts as we know them scientifically. Okay, so that brings us to another one, which is that fetuses experience pain during this procedure. What do we know about whether a fetus in utero experiences pain or does not?
So thus far, what the science has shown is that a fetus, in order to experience pain, has to reach a certain level of neural development. And thus far, we have been only able to ascertain that pain would be felt late in the second trimester, which would be 29, 30 weeks and beyond that. And abortions are not provided past 24 weeks, depending on which state you're in.
In other words, as far as we know, a human being needs to have nerves and pain receptors in order to experience any kind of pain. But there's not really any way to know for sure because you can't ask.
Unfortunately, we do not have the ability to ascertain beyond what we have thus far. And scientists are continuously looking at the most recent evidence to ascertain what is going on. But based on what we have right now, we can say that fetus do not feel pain until after 29 to 30 weeks.
Dee Dee, how long have you been practicing OB-GYN?
I finished training in 2002, so I've been practicing since 2002.
So 15 years.
Yep.
That brings us to yet another common misconception. I think it's a misconception, which is that abortion is skyrocketing. You just made a face. We're on radio. Everyone, she just made a face. According to statistics, the abortion rate in the U.S. is actually at the lowest it's been since 1973. Have you seen that in your practice as well?
Absolutely. Abortion is not skyrocketing. I think having access to better contraception, more effective contraception, has enabled women to be able to make better choices and to decide when and where they want to have children. And so access to contraception has actually contributed greatly to a decrease in the number of abortions.
So let's talk about the very last one that most people list among the top myths surrounding abortion, which is that most women regret having the procedure. And I get that any medical procedure carries stress and anxiety with it. But is there a special burden of stress, anxiety, and regret that comes with this one?
No, I believe that in speaking to my patient and in looking at the evidence that is out there in the scientific literature, that women regret having been in a position where they had to make that decision, but they rarely regret the decision itself. And part of my job when I speak to my patient and when I counsel them is to support them, and sometimes is to help them explore all the options that are available to them. And so as with any other procedure, when I counsel my patients, we counsel them about the risk as well as the alternative. We know that when a woman is pregnant, she has three choices. She may choose to keep the pregnancy. She may choose to give up the child for adoption, or she may choose to terminate the pregnancy. And we discuss those choices with all of our patients. The majority of our patients have already made their decisions by the time they come to us. But my job is to make sure that they know all their choices and to support them whatever choice they choose to make.
Why is it so difficult at this point, in your opinion, for the medical community, the scientific community, to sort of cut through alternative facts, the misinformation that people are getting that makes people have misconceptions and myths in the first place?
There's such a stigma surrounding the choice of having an abortion, and abortion care has been politicized and has been used as part of discussion in the political arena, and they've taken it out of where it belongs, which is in the medical arena between the provider and the patient, allowing the patient to make her decision with the proper information that she needs.
That sounds like you're saying you wish politicians would get out of it and leave it as a medical decision.
Absolutely. I think that politics has no place in the exam room. This is a decision that the patient has to make with her partner, with her spiritual counselor if she needs to, and she needs to come to us for the medical information and for us to counsel her, but there is no place for politics in the exam room.
What, and we have about a minute left. What would be the one thing you would say to women about this procedure and about their medical care? What would be the one most common message you want to give?
I think women need to know that when they have to make the decision and they've made the decision of having an abortion, that the health centers that they will go to, the providers are there to provide compassionate care, and that we're there to support them no matter what their decision is. We cry with our patients, we laugh with our patients, but most of all, we provide them with the most compassionate care that we're capable of.
That's Dee Dee St. Louis. She's a physician for reproductive health in Atlanta. Just ahead, we'll add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. First, though, the music of Adult Swim. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Monday, we'll visit Atlanta-based Adult Swim. The station creates a number of hit TV shows like Rick and Morty, Squidbillies, and The Venture Brothers. There's even a 24/7 online Adult Swim station that's attracted a pretty big following. Adult Swim has also been an important ally to independent musicians since its inception in 2001. All the music you hear on Adult Swim, from bumpers to promos to show soundtracks, are sourced by one guy. Jason DeMarco is Adult Swim's Senior Vice President and Creative Director of On Air.
Hello.
So first, the first thing that comes to mind, obviously, is that you're very busy.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough to have more than one job within my job, but I am very pleasantly busy. Yes. All
like,
the time.
Give me an estimate. How many new bands do you listen to on like a weekly basis?
Well, so I have so much music on my hard drive that I can't do streaming services because just waiting for it to sync with Spotify, my computer crashes.
Wow.
So I'm even.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So I'm one of the only people that probably still buys music. So I probably buy 5 to 7 records a week, every week, pretty much. And that's on an average week.
So, you know, sometimes these corporate collaborations with artists can go really bad.
Yeah. Often.
Yes. I would say more often than not.
Yeah.
So was that in your minds when you first started this?
I mean,
how to avoid it, I mean?
Yeah. I mean, what was in my mind was part of my job is doing partnerships with advertisers. So actually all these music projects were born out of coming up with ideas to involve advertisers to do things that beyond just sponsoring a commercial for a show. And part of what we deal with advertisers is translating the weirdness of Adult Swim through the broadness of your average advertiser message. So through that, I think I learned a lot about how to keep creative sort of firewalled in a way. And I knew that if we were going to do something with musicians, we kind of had to take the same approach.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, but it almost feels as though if it's just coming from an advertising perspective, it would make it harder to create a firewall.
It is. but I had to get the money from somewhere, basically. Before, like, these started by doing extra projects the advertisers would sponsor, and I would use the advertiser money to pay for it. And then once they did well enough and Adult Swim fans kept coming to us and saying, we want more of this, we want more of this. Now we just pay for it out of our own budget for the most part. But it had to prove itself. And I used advertiser money to do that.
So how do you then protect artists from the kind of exploitation that occurs in many of these other corporate collaborations?
We basically keep everything very, very simple. We approach the artist because I already know who they are and I already know what they do, and I am only asking them for a new song that we won't own. We're simply licensing for some period of time. They own it. They will release it on their own however they want. We're only releasing it for a particular window where it's exclusive to us. So going to an artist, it's literally like a bag of money is falling out of the sky to literally do what you're already doing.
Right, to pay you to create something.
To create something you will own, and we are simply licensing, and non-exclusively. So they could even license it to someone else after our little exclusivity period. It's theirs to do with what they will. So it's just such an easy deal for artists. And then when we talk to advertisers, we say, look, the artist is not going to write a song about your product. We're simply approaching them to get a song, and you can help us present it to the public. Because even advertisers are smart enough to know that something good that's free given to, like, anyone on the street is going to leave them with a better impression than something watered down and horrible, or at least a lot of them are smart enough.
Not all of them.
No, not all of them.
Not going to name names.
The ones that want to work with us, maybe, is how I
would. So that must be the philosophy, I don't want to make assumptions, but the philosophy behind where you began with your record label selling music, and now you give it away. Mm-hmm. So is this process what you're talking about here? Why
sort
that
of.
Happened?
We started the record label because we had done some music projects that were very successful with other labels, and we thought, well, why don't we just try it on our own? Unfortunately, this was around 2007 when the music industry was dying.
Tanked.
So we quickly realized, oh, we can't do this. We're not going to make any money at this. So then we had to step back and say, is it worth doing because people like it? Like, is it enough of a thing people associate with Adult Swim that we should keep doing it? And it turned out the answer was yes. So now we just do it as marketing because we get enough response from it that we know that part of the reason, one of many reasons why the average Adult Swim viewer watches Adult Swim, is to discover new things like music.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jason DeMarco, VP and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta's own Adult Swim. And let's actually listen to a little music.
Okay.
This is 20 past four. It's from Noble Oak. So what do you go to the artists with? I mean, do you describe a kind of atmosphere or mood you want, or what do you ask them for?
I really keep it very open, I think. And for me, that's been the best approach, is to go in with no expectations, because some artists will come to me and say, I want to do something really different with you guys than I would normally do. You know, just last week we released a 3-hour song from someone who obviously they couldn't fit a 3-hour song on their own record. So they thought, well, I'll do this. And so there's that. And then the other thing is, I never like telling an artist what to do. And I'm always going to them with my approach is always, I already know who you are. I know your music and I like it. That's why we're coming to you in the first place. So simply do what you do, whatever that is.
You also release whole albums, and
yes.
Here is one of them. This is a song from the show Metalocalypse.
Club.
Yes, what you said. It's this is actually the song Thunder Horse by the fictional band Deathlock. I mean, that sounds exactly like something a band named Deathlock would make.
Deathlock was the band
Death
inside
Clock.
The show Metalocalypse, which aired for, I think, 4 seasons. Yeah, and we made 4 soundtracks, did a couple tours, and those actually sold pretty well.
But so you actually had to go to a band and convince them to be a fictional band named Deathlock.
In the case of that show, it's different. It's basically that one of the show creators, Brendan Small, was a metalhead, and he wrote all the music for the show. And the longer he worked on the show, the more we realized this could be its own thing. So then we did a tour where they had custom animation, and the band themselves were blacked out, and you couldn't see them. And it just was sort of like the animated band was playing all the music. And then the longer they did it...
Kind of like the Gorillaz.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, pretty much. And then the longer they did it, fans realized who was really making the music. And so then it started being a little more normal human interaction type stuff. But that was just, you know, when show creators have a particular musical point of view, and most of them do, we sort of, the same way we do with our other marketing stuff, we just let them sort of take it in whatever direction they want to. And obviously metal is one of the, you know, the genres that our fans really enjoy.
So let me play a song that probably a lot of people will recognize. This is the theme song from the Venture Brothers. It's got that dissonance in it that really fits.
Old school 60s style too. I like it.
Yeah. So then how is the process different when you're just going to a band and saying, okay, we just need you to create something, as opposed to theme music? It seems to be theme music needs a little bit more close collaboration.
Yeah. Theme music will very, very much be a collaboration between whoever the person making the music is and the show creator or the network, depending on who's talking to who. And there's always an approach where we're looking for this particular thing. Do you think you could deliver this style? So those guys knew they wanted a 1960s kind of classic style big band thing, and they went to J.G. Thirlwell, who also records as Fetus, who's a legend, and asked him, we know this isn't something you normally would do. Would you be into this? And sort of he just kept working back and forth with them until they got it to a good place. But it's way more, you know, there's a goal, because the theme show song has to set the tone for what you're about to watch in a way that the things that, like Adult Swim Singles, doesn't have to, because that's just a free song coming out of nowhere. A theme show song has to tell you something about the show.
And that's not short-term either. That lives with the show.
Right, and that's the other thing. Even negotiating that takes way longer, because, you know, when you're giving away a song, you're just licensing it for a period of time. But when you're making a theme song, the network has to somewhat own it, and it has to be able to be used for till the end of time in, you know, all media. So it gets complicated depending on who you're... You know, if you're talking to an established artist like J.G. Thirlwell, a fiercely independent established artist, you have to make sure that you're coming to him with the right type of negotiation, or he'll just go, well, I don't want to do that, you know.
Is there a sound to Adult Swim?
You know, slowly that one has developed, I think. So I would say most of the music we use falls into 3 categories: electronic music, hip-hop, or metal? Because those are kind of the genres that through the years we've seen that fans really connect with. And, you know, to be blunt, that's what I listen to mostly. And I'm the person picking all the music. So we do have shows like Squidbillies that delve into country. We have done songs with folk artists, with country artists, with all genres. But for the most part, the vast majority of the music you're going to hear when you turn on Adult Swim is going to be electronic music, hip hop, or metal of some kind, because those are the three genres that I still think are among the most exciting genres of music that are still changing and coming up with new forms for themselves and on the cutting edge of what can be. And that's kind of what I think, you know, Adult Swim's music should represent that, because I think as a network, we're trying to represent that.
So not much chance for klezmer.
No. Yeah. Not, you're not going to hear much klezmer, probably. I mean, you might, but probably not. I bet we have.
There's a polka slash punk band in Dearborn that, you know.
I know. And I guarantee if you went back through all of our bumps, there was some klezmer or polka used in a bump, but I guarantee it was probably in an ironic way.
So when you are listening to music, even if you like something, are there times when you really like a band but you know that's not going to work for Adult Swim? And if so, what are you hearing?
Yeah, there are times. I mean, there are times when, you know, most of the music that we're going to be using is either going to go in a show or it's going to go on in a bump or some sort of packaging element on television or go in a commercial. And so if it's too slow or too sad, that's going to be rough because we are a comedy channel and we're not sort of known for our slow dramas. So, you know, when you're watching television, the average viewer, you have to keep in mind that you're going into their home and they might be changing the channel and not knowing what they're about to see. So you have to think about how you're curating that experience. And something really, really slow and dirgy will probably kill the momentum. So that's the kind of thing where I may listen to, you know, a 2-hour ambient noise song, but that doesn't mean I'm going to use it in a promo for the Squidbillies because it just
wouldn't. That would be weird.
It wouldn't make sense. Not weird in a good way, just weird. So those are the reasons why I wouldn't use certain songs because they just don't feel right for, hey, I'm watching a comedy network, you know.
Do you think that that Adult Swim sort of reflects the city in which it's made?
I would say so. I mean, we did a whole album of Atlanta rap artists being remixed by independent electronic musicians called ATL Remix. We did that like in 2008, way back. We've worked with Mastodon, Atlanta's number one metal band, for a number of years. We've done a bunch of music videos with them. We've featured a number of Atlanta bands pretty much every year on singles. And then we've done albums. And of course, I've personally been involved a lot with Killer Mike of Run the Jewels.
No, wait. You know. Now, there's a story out there that you actually introduced Killer Mike to LP.
Yeah.
That's a true story?
That is a true story.
Like, you're kind of responsible for Run the Jewels.
Yes. I mean, luckily, Mike...
Did you get that engraved, like, on a plaque?
It'll be... I always say it's going to be what's on my gravestone. It's going to be, like, whatever I've done in my life, that's what people are going to care about, which is fine. That's a good thing to be remembered for as any. But, yeah, Mike and L, I had worked with previously on multiple projects, and when Mike came to me and wanted to do a solo album, we were trying to decide who was going to do the music, and I said, have you heard of this guy LP? And he said, I've heard of him, but I don't really know the music. And so I basically got him to listen to the music. He's like, great, I love this guy. So I called L. L was working on a solo record, and I said, you got to fly down, and I want you to work with Mike on a couple songs for a solo record. And he didn't want to do it because he's a curmudgeon. And I browbeat him into it, and he flew down here, and it was love at first sight. I mean, they spent a day in the studio, recorded 3 songs, and they walked out. Instantly, there was just an instant connection. So then we decided to make the whole rest of the record with L, and then they went on tour together, and kind of that really set it in stone. But yeah, they're very gracious in that they tell people all the time that I introduce
they
them.
They do, yeah. But you never know if that's just being polite,
sure,
or if it's true.
But they're good friends. They both were at my wedding. You know, I mean, we hang out together on vacation, and like we're just buddies. And it's really great to see two people that I know have been working so hard for so long do so well together when they're ready for it. You know, they're ready at this point in their career for that success. They know they've seen highs and lows. They know what to do with it. They know how to appreciate it, and they know how to make it last in a way that if this hit when they were 20, I don't know that they would have been able to hold on like they're doing now.
That's such a perfect transition to my next question is what the advice you might have for doing business as a young artist, because I bet you see young artists making mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
Just in the profession.
Yes.
And there's probably common mistakes, right?
Very much so. Yeah.
What are they?
I would say don't have your best friend be your manager. That's a very good first one. Or your wife.
You see that a lot.
I've seen that a lot, yeah, especially in rap music. I would say read your contracts, read them well, and don't sign any contract that goes beyond two albums. And I would say show up on time, and when you say you're going to do something, do it. Because you'd be surprised how much that happens where someone says, oh, I'm going to do this, and then they don't. And then you have to chase them down so that you can pay them. And it's very simple. It's like just make it easy for someone to work with you so that if they have a good experience, they'll want to do it again. It's very, very simple, but it's a lot harder for people to seemingly get there than you would think.
That's Jason DeMarco, Senior Vice President and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta-based Adult Swim. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we'll add two more tunes to our Essential Georgia playlist, this one from a member of the B-52s. First, though, addressing the state's high rate of truck rollovers. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. It's On Second Thought. We hope you'll join us tomorrow. We'll talk with the creators of a new podcast that revisits the Atlanta child murder case. If you have thoughts about the case and the person who was responsible, call us at 404-500-9457. And of course, be sure to join us at 9 a.m. tomorrow for that conversation. The Georgia Department of Transportation may create a truck-only highway, a 40-mile highway that would go from Macon to McDonough. It would be the first of its kind in the nation. The Georgia DOT estimates traffic would decrease by 40%. Over the next decade or so, and that could make a big difference in the state's truck rollover problem.
Mark Godfrey was driving his fuel truck through this Bibb County area when it flipped over and exploded into flames.
Check this out, an 80,000-pound truck on its side in Fairburn. Alex Perry's father, Darrell, was inside when it happened. At 86 years old, he had to kick his way out of this truck.
A semi-truck crashed near I-75 in Valdosta around 1:30 Thursday morning. Authorities say the semi came to a stop upside down.
These traffic accidents are all too common, especially in Georgia. A report from the American Transportation Research Institute reviewed large trailer truck rollovers in 31 states between 2001 and 2009, and Georgia ranked near the top with some of the most rollovers, according to that study. There were more than 4,500 accidents like these statewide over those years, and nearly 200 were fatal. Tim McElwaney of Atlanta has driven trailer trucks for more than 30 years. We spoke to him a couple years ago, and he told us he's never been involved in a major accident. That's a record he's proud of.
We will do everything humanly possible to keep from hitting somebody. And when somebody cuts us off, we'll snatch that wheel left or right to keep from hitting them. And when you turn that wheel hard like that, you get a whiplash effect, and the payload will move. If it moves just right, it'll tip that truck right over.
For more on Georgia's truck rollover problem, I spoke with three guests in 2015. John Woodruff studies transportation safety with the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Atlanta attorney Eric Rogers represents clients involved in trailer truck accidents. And I also spoke with GDOT spokeswoman Natalie Dale. Natalie, let me begin with you. I'm sure that the Georgia Department of Transportation has looked at this issue and why Georgia is at the top of this list. What has the department come up with?
Well, I think you have to look at, as a region, how we rank as a freight network. When you look at states throughout our nation, Georgia has one of the highest numbers of truck populations. We have a lot of trucks coming through our state, so it's not very surprising that we would have that we would rank high here, because we, as a state, have the majority of truck traffic. When you look regionally, us, sort of the Ohio, Michigan area, and some of our western states, primarily because of what's coming in through through our port. Atlanta's a big city. It's sort of the heart of the South. So you have a lot of goods coming in to Atlanta and leaving Atlanta. There's also a lot of interchanges in our state that trucks are coming through. We have a big freight network here. And so when you sort of put together that not only a lot of truck traffic, but a lot of traffic, period, congestion, just like the truck driver was saying, is that we have a lot of weaving. We have a lot of trucks and a lot of traffic congestion going together. And that doesn't always create the best atmosphere.
Okay, so then let me put this to you, John, because, I mean, if you want to talk about a lot of truck traffic, you're in Michigan. There's a lot of truck traffic coming through Michigan. What causes rollover accidents in most cases? Is there a common cause?
The most common one is that the vehicle is approaching a curve and in a curve at too high a speed, or as the driver mentioned, there is some sort of event that requires the truck driver to take evasive action. And trucks are different than cars in that they have a very high center of gravity. So in a challenging situation like that, their default is to roll over, where a car's default is to spin and lose control. So the vehicle systems are quite different, and trucks are prone to roll over.
Eric, how often is the driver of the truck at fault for these accidents?
The two key things that we see in these accidents is, one, fatigued drivers that are being pushed by their companies to not necessarily exceed their hours, but push it as far as possible. And so when you have that along with speed, in that they have to get somewhere by a specific time, it creates a recipe for disaster. And this is what happens, is they're not given the opportunity by their companies to be a safe and prudent driver out on the roadways.
I wanted to play you another clip from the truck driver we spoke with, Tim McElwainy. And he's talking here about the technology that he has in his truck. And I understand this isn't common to all trucks here. So take a listen about what he's saying here about roll stability.
We use the roll stability on our trucks. It is designed to break certain wheels to keep the truck from turning over. And it's helped several drivers throughout our company avoid terrible situations.
This isn't the only one, the roll stability that he's talking about. In other words, exactly that the wheel will snap rather than the whole truck falling over. Do most trucks that are out on the roads have this kind of thing?
No, you're not going to see a lot of that technology as far as from a rollover standpoint on these trucks, simply because you're dealing with companies of various sizes, small mom and pop shops to your very large companies, and they have to make an economic decision about what to put on their trucks.
And this is an expensive technology.
Every type of technology that they're adding to their trucks, whether it's a collision avoidance system, whether there's one called VORAD that helps avoid lane changes, or this, is an added cost to them, and they take that into account. So at some point, they have to weigh that versus what they consider the benefit of it.
And John, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, wants to create these new speed control mandates for trucks as well. What would this speed control mandate do?
I can speak more effectively to the technology that you were just mentioning, and it's sort of tied in there. But essentially, these electronic stability control systems, they're able to sense when the truck is getting into trouble before the driver knows that. And it can effectively throw the brakes on in a blink of an eye and quickly change the speed of the truck so it can negotiate the curve. So this technology has a way of monitoring what the driver is doing through the course of his day, and then when an error does occur, it can come out and actually save the day for the driver. So in a sense, that's probably the most effective speed control mechanism available.
So right now we're talking about technology that can be installed in trucks, but Natalie, there are ways in which we can build roads better. I mean, John was talking about how often the curves are really steep. There's one particular ramp that I'm sure your department has been heard about, and that's the ramp from Interstate 285 southbound going to Interstate 20 eastbound. It's a nearly 180-degree curve, and it's had a large number, a higher than normal number of rollover accidents here. Part of that is because you can't tell. I went and drove it. You can't tell necessarily there's a curve coming. It almost looks like it's going to be straight.
all of our interchanges are designed to national standards.
Right.
So what we're going to do at these is look at what kind of signage, whether that's overhead blinking signage, whether that's signage, chevron signage that highlights the curve. While we can do what we can as far as the future of designing roads, as well as ample signage and warnings, we do need compliance. And I think as a driving society, we've become kind of numb to some of these signs. When we see the sign that indicates a truck would flip over and you need to bring your speed limit down to 35, we're not kidding. We need you to do that in order to safely navigate through that interchange.
So, Eric, you know, Georgia, when you look at statistics on a number of things that relate to our roads, we don't have the best record. We have a high number of pedestrian fatalities. We have a high number of bike fatalities. We have a high number of rollover accidents. Is there some way in which perhaps driver education is missing? Is it because we're a transient population? What are your thoughts here on what's going on our roads?
Part of it is a transient city, so people aren't necessarily familiar with our roadways, at least in the Atlanta area. You know, people always joke about, you know, getting to and from places in Atlanta is very difficult, whereas you go to New York, you just know whether you're going north, south, or east, west, and you'll get there. I think that adds to a bit because people are unable to foresee what hazards may be aware, and they're spending more time trying to figure out where to go than what's exactly in front of them. I think that's something that needs to be addressed by the legislature in the upcoming sessions as to how much more to curtail use of cell phones in cars and in trucks.
So, John, help me understand what can be done. Are there states that have looked at, say, rollover accidents in particular and taken steps that were particularly effective?
Well, I can say on a national basis, NHTSA, that organization you mentioned in the federal government, has conducted studies to understand, you know, the effectiveness of technologies. And at the end of the day, we're really dealing with human error. And you can't legislate human error. You can't effectively have compliance on that. You can get close, but really these technologies have been developed recently and are really very effective at dealing with moments of distraction, moments of forgetfulness and error. And if we can come to terms with the fact that human error is very much a part of the problem that we're seeing today, and then once we admit that, then we can say, listen, we have some technology that can go a long way to help support that and to support the human during those moments when error occurs. And this is the fantastic benefit of electronic stability control and rollover stability that Tim was talking about.
Well, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but certainly I would think, Natalie, that your advice would be for everyone simply to watch their speed.
Beyond that, watch your speed, put your phone down, buckle up. Driving is a responsibility, and you need to be engaged in that responsibility, not worrying about your radio or your phone or checking your email. Be an aware driver. GDOT has launched the Drive Alert, Arrive Alive campaign to start having this conversation that we are far too distracted behind the wheel. Speed is a big issue with not only tractor trailers, but with just an average commuter. Not obeying compliance with posted signs is something that we really need in this state.
That's Natalie Dale of the Georgia Department of Transportation. And we also spoke with Atlanta attorney Eric Rogers, and we heard from John Woodruff with the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
And now let's hear a little music to go along with perhaps your commute. This one from the B-52s. We asked one of the group's founding members to add two more songs to our Essential Georgia playlist. The rules are very simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and it can't be one of their own songs. So here's another installment of the Georgia playlist.
One, two, one, two, three.
Hi, my name is Kate Pearson from the B-52s, and also from Kate Pearson, Guitars and Microphones, my solo record. My first choice of songs from a Georgia artist, Augusta G.A., Hot Pants, James Brown.
Take your pines up home. It looks much better time. My people keep going.
James Brown is unique, and he's just, there's just something raw and beautiful and just ever, you know, it's eternal. You know, it's like it doesn't age. That song does not age. It doesn't ever sound old, any of James Brown's stuff, you know, and I think a lot of artists feel that way, that he's on one of the top of the list.
Hot pants make you shoot yourself. Good God, you won't like.
Back in the day when the B-52s started, we would dance at the drop of a hat. We'd go over to our friend John Taylor's house. He'd bake cornbread. He was always cooking, so we gravitated to his house. And he'd put on James Brown or Shotgun or something, and we would just dance around the table. We would dance with that cornbread. We would dance, you know, in the middle of the day. So James Brown was one of those people that you could not stop dancing. If Hot Pants was on, you had to get up and dance. Hot pants, smoking. Okay, the second song on my list of Georgia artists from Macon, Georgia, "Tutti Frutti" by Little Richard. It's the same kind of thing as James Brown in a way. You can't stop dancing, and he's also sort of the king of rock and roll, or the one of the fathers of rock and roll. It's one of those songs that you could say, okay, the lyrics really are genius in their simplicity.
She rocked to the east, she rocked to the west, but she's the gal that I love best.
You know, do people just say like, oh, what do these crazy lyrics mean? No, sometimes they'll take B-52 songs out of context and, you know, they'll read the lyrics and say, this is just so like, how can this be a song? But, you know, this is an example of these lyrics, which apparently he got from some teenage girl, I think he heard, overheard, or she said Tutti Frutti. But, you know, you get your inspiration from wherever. But I mean, that is just so genius the way he put that together. And it's just in some ways nonsense, but in some ways is the most profound thing you could ever sing. Tutti Frutti. Oh, Rudy. Tutti Frutti. Nobody could sing like Little Richard. He's one of a kind. Also, like growing up, you know, gay and Macon, I mean, he's got to be like made of some tough stuff. And I think he's just, you know, just such a brave person to grow up, you know, and do the music he did. And I just think he blazed a trail. I don't think there's one particular sound for the state. No, there's just, Athens is a unique sound. I think Macon had its sound, certainly. And there's the really big rap scene in Atlanta. So there's an Atlanta sound, I think, too. And there's a lot of creativity in Georgia.
That's singer-songwriter Kate Pearson of the B-52s with her picks for our ever-growing Essential Georgia playlist. Kate picked music superstars of Augusta and Macon, but we all know she's an Athens girl at heart. That's our show for today, but we always love to hear from you. So tell us your favorite song by a Georgia artist, even if it's already on the playlist. We still want to know. Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter or Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.